You realize that mainstream media has sold you a box of rocks. It's time to tune into The Kate Daly Show, America's newest addiction. The show starts now.
If reelected, would you increase the frequency of garbage pickup?
Well, citizen, that's an excellent question, and I thank you for it. I think it's great we live in a town where you can ask questions. Because without questions, we just have answers. And an answer without a question is a statement.
Oh, I like him. He looks me in the eye.
I love that clip. I do. I love that clip. Oh, it's just timeless. That's what's so sad. It's timeless. I mean, how often are they chosen for that reason? Welcome to the Kate Daly Show. Glad to have you on board. And, of course, call in 888-673-1450, 888-673-1450. What's on your mind? We're right smack in the middle of graduation week. And so Melissa will be joining me, and we're going to be talking about some kind of interesting things in the next hour. I can't wait. Namely, one of them being graduation. Kind of interesting, some things that she's pulled up, and also some other things that are kind of intriguing, things that we did in history that are kind of intriguing that you might want to just listen to. In the last hour, Susan comes in, and we've got a lot to talk about as well. A lot of headlines and maybe what's going on behind the scenes. And then, we just have a loaded show. Every day feels like a loaded show. But I welcome you and I welcome your calls. I'm in studio by myself. So, of course, I'm going to want your calls. Why not? 888-673-1450. I was kind of laughing. We were actually laughing about this yesterday, Uncle Milty and I. We didn't really get to it on the air. But climate change. There was an actual article in Fox News. And this is why both news outlets are so tainted. And that's what makes me sad, is that a lot of people, hook, line, and sinker, think anything Fox puts up is going to be true. So they put up an article, climate change could raise sea levels by 7 feet by the year 2100. Shocking study reveals, you know, they're not even poking fun at it. They're actually saying, yes, this will happen. And this is by Chris Kashia. Anyway, he writes a lot about these kinds of issues. For some reason, he's on staff there. So I'm not quite sure why, because this wasn't a letter to the editor or anything like that. And so he was saying New York City could see once in a lifetime floods every 5 years. And he's going on and on and on about this and demonstrating it as fact, you know, writing about it as it's fact. And I was kind of chuckling because I had just barely seen something that said, that was talking about the 400 people that died in New York. They considered it one of the storms of the century. And when snow blanketed 24 inches within, I think it was 24 hours. I mean, it was a crazy amount of snow within 1 hour. But we've had, oh gosh, if you want to go there, we've had the Great Blizzard of 88, the Great Blizzard of 99, the Storm of the Century, the White Hurricane, the Children's Blizzard, the Great Appalachian Storm, the Knickerbocker Storm in 1922, the Armistice Day Blizzard. And I could go on and on, the Super Bowl blizzard. And then when it gets to the heat wave of 1896, heat wave of 1934, heat wave of 1936 and 54 and 1980 and 88 and 95 in Chicago, and heat wave of 2006 and 2012. This has been going on for eons. Whenever you look out at the weather and you think, this is odd, why does my May look like this? Just remember that it's just so darn cyclical. And also that we're going to have periods of cold weather, periods of hot weather. And I know that they love to push climate change down our throats to make us, if you've noticed, people have more fear about, now this year just seems different. Well, it seems different because it is. It's different from the year before and the year before that and the year before that. And we're different from 1899. And we were different in 1945. And it just is. And when they keep purporting that it's climate change, I just have to laugh. And when you look at Fox News, be careful who you're reading, too, because I know you know this. I'm preaching to the choir, but it's just so frustrating. It's so frustrating because the headline was so, yep, they're right. You know, those progressive, they're right. Man alive. What a scam. Okay. By the way, make sure you get over to Defending Utah, defendingutah.org. They are fantastic. And I know you know that because I know you've probably been there by now, but you got to get their newsletter and they can help you be a really an effective citizen, which is really important. So I love what they're always working on. They're always working on something and they're really great journalists. And so get behind them. They are really trying out there and doing a fantastic job. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. If you noticed in the news clip, if you were listening local, talked about the fact that Washington County commissioners are approving an agreement Tuesday that calls for the county to split the costs of SkyWest Airlines' newly announced route with the city of St. George. Here we go, another route. Now, I know some of you are probably excited about this. It goes to Dallas, but that's not the point. That is clearly not the point. St. George News put up this article. It was during the same meeting, a proposed $381,000 paving project for Harmony Heights. And so they went on to talk about that. But I want to talk about SkyWest because the county commission approved a transportation service agreement between Washington County, St. George, and SkyWest to deliver the new airline route to Dallas. And the new route's going to open in September following the reopening of the airport. And so according to the agreement, they're going to split St. George and Washington County. They're going to split the startup cost of the $450,000 route. You heard me right. They're going to split the startup cost of the $450,000 route, which you know isn't going to end there because the flight to California didn't end there either, in funding. But it's meant to act as a contingency fund to help cover possible losses of the flight's first year. Possible? Well, we have history to dictate to us that there will be losses, and they particularly had losses when only SkyWest was doing it, so this will be kind of interesting, won't it? Yeah, possible. Possible my rear end. Yeah, they're going to have losses and you get to pay for it. So Commissioner Dean Cox was saying, wow, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth is huge and wow, isn't this great and sparkly and fun and neat? It is, but it isn't and it shouldn't. Now, I say shouldn't because this has been a kind of a longstanding thing, which I'll talk about, but we shouldn't be paying for this. We should not be paying for this. So. We have this destination and everyone's real excited because, you know, it's exciting. But virtually what happens within this and how long we attach ourselves to it as the county is a whole nother thing. The county entered into that previous agreement that I was talking about in St. George and SkyWest. They cover the startup costs of Los Angeles. How's that working for them? We'll get into that. So this is where I wanted to go on this. Our federal involvement in airports is interesting because in early airports through post office operations and public works programs in the early 20th century, the federal government became increasingly more involved in airport funding. This was after the taxation of airline passengers that was established in a Revenue Act in 1941. Okay, so airport funding was provided by the general fund until the Airport Development Act of 1970, which established the Airport and Airway Trust Fund. And when I say these things, I'm not saying that it actually has any authority to do this. Yeah, government should have no place in this. So the AATF, which is the Airport and Airway Trust Fund, dispenses grants in order to airports backed by dedicated funding source of taxes levied on passenger tickets and other aviation related activities. So the framework of that trust fund included the Airport Improvement Program, which was established by Airport and Runway Improvement Act of 1982. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jay.
Hey there. Hi there, Uncle Mel.
Do they say anywhere how much of profit we might be able to expect to split with the airline?
No, just the fact that we're paying for it and we're going to incur some losses. Sounds fair, doesn't it?
No. Profit sharing, though.
No.
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, good point. Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Well,
appreciate
thanks.
That. Yeah, you know, we never... We never get to profit in these deals. So airport options for raising revenue became kind of constrained after these legal challenges limited the airport's ability to levy the fees on passengers who use their facilities. So in 1970, Delta Airlines sued Indiana's airport authority for enacting an ordinance that required airlines to collect a dollar per passenger fee on its behalf and then remit the revenues to the airport. And Delta claimed that the fee constituted an impediment to interstate commerce. Isn't it interesting how interstate commerce comes up again and again and again? In these, I get why they're saying it here, but I think it's used and used and used and used. So they were violating, they said they were thus violating the Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. So the case was taken up by the Supreme Court in what was called Evansville versus Delta, and this is in 1970. And it ruled against Delta and upheld the constitutionality of a per passenger fee. So the court argued that as so long as the toll is based on some fair approximation of use or privilege for use and is not excessive in comparison with the government benefit conferred, that the passenger fees did not discriminate against interstate commerce and travel and are legal. So when the local airport charges passed constitutional muster, and I'm going to have to add that it didn't pass muster. It didn't pass authority. What it passed was interpretation. They subsequently faced an even greater challenge from all those special interests in Congress. So the classic case of cronyism, Delta and other carriers, they all successfully lobbied Congress to decide that contra the Supreme Court per passenger fees did inhibit interstate commerce. And the lobbying resulted in this enactment of a provision that prohibited passenger fees at airports in the Airport Development Acceleration Act of 73. So that was known as the Anti-Head Tax Act, Section 7 of the U.S. Code, states that no state or government shall, you love the word shall, levy or collect a tax, fee, head charge, or other charge directly or indirectly on persons traveling in air commerce. And so while all that might sound a little boring, it's very interesting to me how they move along the Constitution to interpret exactly in a lot of different areas what needs to be going on in the interpretation of the Constitution, especially when it comes to interstate commerce. Very, very interesting. So passengers now pay a variety of federal taxes because, you know, that's the only way it goes, right? We just keep paying more. And so the revenues are then used for FFA operations. So 7.5% domestic passenger ticket tax, $4 per passenger domestic flight segment tax, you name it. It just keeps going. I'm going to be right back on the Kate Daly Show. You can call up 888-673-1450 when I come back.
There you go.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Welcome back. Kate Daly Show here. Get over to ABC. If you are in a car accident, especially get over to ABC Auto Body Central. Make sure that you're giving them your business, because they'll do it for far less. They'll also do it right, and they'll do it fast. And you get to choose your provider when you're in an accident, which makes it so much better to be able to go to ABC Auto Body Central. I really love those guys, and they're honest. That's what I like about them. They do good work, and they're honest. That's what you want. They can fix anything cosmetic, and they just do a fantastic job, and they're perfectionists, which I love. 817-0949. 817-0949. Make sure you're getting over there. ABC. It's stgeorgeautobody.com if you want to go to the website. And I was just talking about airlines, and we're funding yet another route. And usually the reason that the commissioners will put out there is it helps tourism. And and it's amazing, and it's sparkly and new and fun, and I get it. It's so fun. But the problem is that we're funding it, and that is a problem, actually. It's been a problem for a long time that government is so intertwined with airlines and airports. And, you know, this, I was going through the acts that sort of made that happen, and some of the court cases with Delta and so forth, and charging a per head fee, you know, who flies, and how that's translated into Uber taxes for us. But I think that in the event of looking at a city and what we're willing to fund in the name of tourism is really the question. The flight to L.A., you know, we were promised that would help tourism and that would put money in our pocket. Have you noticed a huge success from it? Have we been able to reap the benefit? Because that happened, 2 years ago, right? Year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So where's all the benefit? Because I know we get told that, and I know that it sounds really nice, but I don't think it's really equating. It's equating to what you and I would consider probably a benefit that we're feeling. When they use tax dollars and they give it to and they give it for startup runs, because they even said this is a startup cost, where it's a startup business, really, as part of that business of SkyWest, to send a flight to Dallas and back. They don't know that they're going to fill those seats. Nobody does. And when SkyWest did that flight to L.A., they couldn't fill the seats. And what did the county do? They decided to go in and rescue it and do it again and put our dollars into it. Is that the right thing to do? And why are we involved in such startup costs? Why are we involved in these kinds of things? You know, fees can be waived, I think, for up to 2 years, something like that. Marketing, fees and all kinds. They do all kinds of, well, I'll do this for you and you do this for me, and we'll be able to get this going. But like Uncle Milty said when he called in, are we getting some profit in this? If we're going to go into business and they're going to use our tax dollars, doesn't that make us an investor into SkyWest? Well, it should. They're using our money to help pay for it. I would imagine that we would be an investor now. So where does the public get their cash from something going right? So they say that, you know, airports generate aeronautical revenue, which includes fees paid by airlines for use of runways and gates. And there's all kinds of revenue coming in from these things. And that up until the early 90s, cities that owned their own airports were frequently commingled with non-aeronautical revenue with the general coffers to pay for the urban infrastructure like fire departments. Do you feel like this is really intertwined? I do. I feel like there's a huge problem with this. And so by the early 90s, the U.S. Airlines were struggling, but shouldn't you just let them struggle? I mean, honestly, all businesses go through, I just lost my train of thought. They all go through, you know, huge gains and huge losses, right? But for some reason, when it comes to the media, the banks, and the airlines, we don't allow that. So Congress and the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, limited use of non-aeronautical revenue, you know, to the airport itself. And then a few years later, after all this heavy lobbying from the airlines, the FAA decided that airports could use the money to waive landing fees and pay for route marketing. And it became extremely intertwined into the pocket of Americans in cities and counties everywhere. This has been longstanding. I wouldn't say tremendously long, but long enough. So as far as this goes, when we're looking at a city and we're involved in a startup business and we're saying we're going to cover some losses, you can bet there's going to be losses, just like there was in the other routes we've done. And we have no place to do this. There's no authority for this. Do you remember what amendment in the Constitution granted this? And somebody could say, well, we didn't have airplanes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. We could be flying broomsticks. It doesn't matter. They have no place in that. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Well, I can't agree with you more in your last statement. This is really important. We talk about was there a benefit or not?
Mm-hmm.
Did local tourist industry benefit or not? That is really the wrong question, because this is legally theft. Mm-hmm. They're taking money, giving it to their buddies, mm-hmm. friends, and in this case, a $1 billion corporation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if welfare is wrong for the poor, it's certainly wrong for it to be given to a $1 billion corporation. But the point there, every welfare program, somebody is not going to benefit from that money being taken from them. If one person doesn't benefit, then it's wrong. And mm-hmm. if one person doesn't want it, and there's somebody that's not going to benefit. They don't travel. They don't use local tourists. So the question of whether it benefits or not is really a moot question.
Mm-hmm.
It's immoral to take money to give to others. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to also mention on that, you're talking about the laws. That was really interesting, that mm-hmm. 1970 law,
mm-hmm.
where they used as the argument the interstate commerce law.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we get when people are so dumbed down about the Constitution. Interstate mm-hmm. commerce law was solely, if you look at the original intent, to prevent tariff wars between states.
Yes.
What does mm-hmm. tariff wars between states have anything to do with
with flying in between states?
Yeah. Taxing the consumers of a business. Yeah. It has nothing. What they violated was the Bill of Rights, the 10th
mm-hmm.
Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
All powers not reserved to the states or to the, all powers delegated to the federal government that aren't delegated to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved to the states or the people.
Mm-hmm.
There is no power about the federal government mm-hmm. controlling, regulating, taxing mm-hmm. any business at all.
Oh, yeah.
So
and on your point of interstate commerce, we have turned it into the fact that you cross state lines. It's now interstate commerce. So that's subject to anything. You as a citizen go to help another citizen, like in the Bundy case. You go across state lines. Now they can take that into the equation. They can also take into the equation too flying over state lines. I mean, it's ridiculous where they've gone.
And but they can't change the Constitution, and it's our fault for allowing them to say the Constitution says something else.
Yeah.
In this case, they could have said, "Well, the veto provisions in the second Article 2 allow us to do this."
Mm-hmm.
None of these provisions. None of these clauses have anything to do with they have a power to tax the consumers in a particular business like this.
Right.
And this is all our fault. We keep voting these people back into office. We've got to stop doing it.
I agree. Thank you so much. And the reason I mentioned that question is, did we benefit, is because that's what we were sold on. Obviously, this does not even match up, even loosely, with the Constitution. At all. So they have granted themselves authority to become intertwined airlines and government. But my point was that always what the reasoning is and what we're sold on, even though that's not right, what we're sold on is this is going to benefit you, community. It's going to benefit you, and in tourism, it'll benefit you, and this will be good for our community, and you'll see. And it's new, and wow. So there was an article, it was called Next City, and it was kind of very Agenda 21-ish, if you will. But this is what they said, and I thought this was a great point because it really is what this is about. And the guy Ryerson said, everybody wants to be a big, important global city. And cities see big, important international airports as the way to get there. So he said, this is what leads to the abuse. This is what leads to the abuse of incentive programs. Now, he was mostly talking about that because he was talking about how intertwined they were and how dependent they were on government. And so when you look at these airline companies and you think you're dealing with a private company, we're not. And I think one of the illusions in America is that we have all these private companies. We don't. So many of them are government-funded or government-controlled or both. That's the problem. So when he said everybody wants to be a big, important global city, that's why they're out there with, it's new and shiny and how cool and we should like tourism. Do you know, we've already spent a grundle on tourism. We already have a lot of tourism coming in. We have a race every other weekend, if anyone's noticed. And I do, because driving around Saturday is kind of a madhouse. So we already are bringing that in. This is just wanting to be a big, important global city. And why? Because I'll tell you this, most people here don't want it to be. The reason they moved here was so that it wasn't that. We moved out of those big, important global cities to move here. And if you're listening, I don't even care where you're listening from. If you don't live in a city, but you live in more of a suburbish area, you'll probably identify with that statement, because that's the idea of local government, not so much the citizenry. So the local government goes, ooh, yeah, we got more budget, we got more money coming in, we got all these opportunities, we get to do all this stuff. But at the end of the day, not only do they not have the authority to do it, and they never look at themselves and try to change that. You know what they do? They say, well, precedent was set. Precedent was set. They did it for the last 30 years, so why can't we? Instead of standing up and saying, you know what, this isn't okay. It's not okay to go into a startup business run and spend the taxpayer dollars to $500,000 at the very least, because we know that's not all that we'll spend, to do it. So there's no authority to do it. And then at the same time, what's given to us in what we think is a reward isn't really a reward, because not only do we not feel it or see it, and I'm not talking about the do they have authority, that one pretty much shoots down the whole argument anyway. But when they promise you something and you're going to get something in return, I'm going to bet dollars to donuts that you don't ever see it, and that I don't ever see it. We never feel it. We never see it. But I do feel like my community is on the hunt for tourism dollars every 5 seconds, and that's the only thing that matters to them. The citizens' way of life, who we are as a community, what we like about our community, should come into play, but it doesn't. It's all about getting the next contract, or whatever city council member owns land or works for some industry, or the county commissioners have some industry that's impacted by the change, by dealing with all these other companies and handing our tax dollars over. This has got to stop, but we need a very strong city council and county commissioners that are willing to say, no, we're not going to do this. It's not right. And I don't care about precedent. They shouldn't care about it either. They should just want to change it and say, this isn't okay. That's where I stand. It's probably where you guys stand too, I would imagine. This is just, how many more runs are we going to fund to feel important and big and shiny and new? I don't know, but the LA one sure isn't really working out for us. Okay. Be right back on the Kate Daly Show.
Talk lines are open now. Call 888-673-1450. This is the Kate Daly Show.
If your garage is your body shop, if your dog's got room to run, you might be from a small town. And if you've ever kissed a girl, spinning around on a tilted world at the county fair in the summer sun, from a small town.
I kind of like it, by the way. That's why I came. Anyway, welcome back to the Kate Daly Show. Glad you're joining me. We just went through, the government entanglement from 1941, which really lit up in the 70s, led to airports being very intertwined with government. And it's been such a huge mistake, because I still think people think these companies are independent. They're not. They're not independent private companies. And I think that the government involvement, well, obviously there was no authority to do it. They invented the authority, like they do on so many things. In fact, in the last hour today, I want to share something with you that I've talked about a lot, but I've never done it from this angle. And so I will come at a different angle, maybe give some more context on a very, very big issue right now in the headlines. But I'll welcome the caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you, Kate.
Hi.
I don't know if people understand that your local regional airports, mm-hmm. those are all subsidized. So when you fly from St. George to Salt Lake City, you're not paying the full cost of that ticket. The government's picking up a share of it to keep that route open.
Yes, I'm glad you said that. Absolutely, you're right. And
to keep a rural air service. they
yeah.
call it.
Yeah. Because why? Because it promotes growth and cities like it. And they have all kinds of fees and taxes onto it now for you, the citizen. They have a segment tax, a passenger facility charge, a security fee, a domestic ticket tax. I mean, all kinds of taxes on here. And they don't even go to the airport or airway trust fund, by the way. But it's kind of amazing, well, like you said, that them being subsidized, because I would actually like to work with just a private company and just pay the full ticket and have those companies compete against each other for my business. Wouldn't you?
Yeah. There's other subsidies that occur that we don't even understand. I mean, one of the largest ones we have around here that always boggles my mind is, I don't know if people know, but the Colorado City Airport out in Hilldale, Colorado City, is actually a designated emergency runway, and you can land a 747 on that runway. It's almost 2 miles long.
Jeez.
It's bigger than our airport in runway length.
I did not know that. Interesting.
Right.
Interesting.
And how was that selected, that they put it there instead of here in St. George, where we have the land and the need for it? It was put into you have to wonder who was the kickbacks and who was getting the hey, yeah, on that deal.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's a reason they put it out. There's always a reason. Yeah, I agree.
Well, yeah. You know, that city was actually able to buy their own power system. They actually bought a complete turbine generator system that I don't think it ever even went online.
Wow.
But it costs in the neighborhood of $14 million of government of energy department money that was spent.
Yeah, it would be fun to know.
So that the city of Colorado City could have, or Hilldale could have, its own electrification power, they generate their own power.
Jeez Louise. Well, thank you.
And yet here in St. George, we have all kinds of problems with power.
Yeah, we do, actually. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. They don't get any better, which is kind of surprising. So,
well, we're not increasing our generation. We do a little bit, but not enough. So we have problems. We have to run more high lines out to the outer reaches. We build more houses out in remote areas away from the center of where the generation is at. So we have to put in high lines that pay. That's expensive to put in the high tension three phase all the way out there.
I agree. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yep. It's great. Great comment, by the way. 20%, by the way, of total AIP funding comes from state block grants. State block grants means we pay for it. So that's short for you just got screwed. You pay for it. And so the program provides funding directly to states, which then assume responsibility. And so when you pay those taxes, by the way, they filter back to the airlines with the government taking their cut. It's very interesting, the whole process by which your taxes that you pay when you fly and taxes that go to the airport, how they're funneled and everybody gets their cut. So they have discretionary grants too, all kinds of different routes that they do. I think 12.5% on that. So there's that. I also wanted to broach this subject. We were going to broach it yesterday, and I just wanted to mention this. A lot of people think zoning laws are here to protect the value of a home, like say from a bar opening up next door to their bedroom, right? And there is some merit in that because, you know, you buy a home and you're kind of sunk into that home. And so you would like homes around you. I get it. And I think everybody understands that. But there's such a history. So the history of zoning laws, just so you know, because I always find history really fascinating. How did this stuff start and why? In 1880, almost near the turn of the century, the San Francisco passed a law requiring licensing for laundries in wooden buildings. And that might have been a good idea because of a potential fire hazard, but those enforcing the law singled out the Chinese. And so all white-owned laundries received licenses, and all the Chinese were denied them. And so Mr. Yik Wu, if that was his real name, refused to shut his place and was arrested, confined to jail, and fought the city. So the big case was Yik Wu versus Hopkins, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the court ruled, now they should say the court opined, that the law appeared to be race neutral as it was written out and was enforced by a discriminatory manner. And the justices concluded that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, it's going to come up again today, so applied that Mr. Yik, even through the law at the time, denied him the opportunity to be a citizen. The effort to control the people lived and worked wasn't the last, and it was only the beginning. So progressives introduced the idea of scientific management to government in the 19th century, and they applied that to land use planning, the idea they borrowed from Europe, by the way. Germany and England were two of the first nations to adopt land use planning. Sounds a little Agenda 21-ish, doesn't it? Ultimately providing this model for U.S. codes. So Los Angeles, Boston, New York, they were all early adopters. When are they not? I mean, what, just throw Chicago and Baltimore in the mix and Detroit. And it's like the trifecta of cities that lob on to anything like this early on. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they saw a number of public issues intersect. So public health concerns being discussed along with immigration and eugenics. Remember that, too, for the third hour discussion we're going to have. So science and pseudoscience were all mixed together. And immigrants from Southern Europe and African Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans and general poor, they fell victim to political decisions based on poor information while people were trying to make a name for themselves or a feather for their own nest, right, to benefit. So in 1910, Baltimore adopted the first zoning laws. See, Baltimore, see? The first zoning laws that were openly drawn to keep African Americans and whites separated by law. Gotta love that. And in 1910, see how laws, government decided to do those things, even though really we got a great start, didn't we, with the Constitution? Anyway, they were openly drawn to keep people separated. And in 1910, Baltimore, I won't go through the whole quote, but it said blacks should be quarantined, right, to isolated slums in order to reduce the incidence of civil disturbance. And then all these other cities followed. And so the process spread quickly, and it was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1917 in a case called Buchanan and Worley. And so the court's decision did not stop cities and towns nationwide from passing all these laws. So really started out with this. Isn't that kind of interesting? And then central to the planning for the future, there were a couple of men responsible for much of the discrimination that was taking place in zoning laws. And anyway, so they went on to play a big part in this and get other cities on board. And they worked on plans for 500 or more cities across the nation. And they wanted, really at the heart of zoning laws, was sort of a zeal just to control what people do. Hi, government. And the political elites often end up with little to show for their efforts. So there was a decision in 1926. It had a really wide impact. And the land involved would remain vacant for 20 years in this case. Maybe the local kids played ball on it. Who knows? But eventually the federal government seized it during World War II and built a defense plant there. And after the war, General Motors used the place to build auto parts. And today the property is used mainly to sell industrial machinery. And so it's interesting to kind of know how uses affect the value of the nearby property. You know, when you look at cities and why they own property and where, that's always kind of interested me as well. And so years back, a few years ago, a city of Euclid placed a memorial on the site to remember the importance of the 1926 ruling on this particular piece of land that ended up in a lawsuit. No mention is made of the damage to the relationships between the races or the cost to the public caused by zoning regulations on that memorial. I do, and that comes to us from Michael Wilson. I will say this, it is definitely there to control, so they can control the planning of a community. But I always wonder how you feel about that, because some people will think that's a good thing, that that's what they're hired to do, in a sense. City council. Yeah, you pay for police and fire trucks. You make sure roads are paved, but you're really there to make sure that the city is planned accordingly. But when I see people in city government that pass along those benefits of that city planning to themselves, or they just, I don't know, really seem to love buying businesses, selling businesses, buying land, selling land, all of these kinds of things, that worries me. It should worry you. But I also, the control factor. Do you remember the Airbnb ruling here where they basically, I think it was John Pike flew up to Salt Lake and told everybody that we didn't want Airbnb? I don't think that was true. I think the amount of people doing Airbnb was very, very, very low. But he definitely didn't want it here. And so he told everybody up in Salt Lake when he flew up there on our dime that we didn't want it. So, and I think that was after just receiving a few letters, if I'm not mistaken. So that was a zoning thing. It was where industries can reside. And so kind of interesting that was done, I think, in a huge effort to get these hotels their business, even though historically Airbnb doesn't really take a lot from those businesses. More people are actually going to come if they can do Airbnb, because some people are just set on the idea of Airbnb, renting a room in your house. But I did think it was interesting because of the way it was done, and also because it really wasn't listening. It really wasn't listening to us, to the citizen. I think it was just, we're going to preserve our city planning the way we want to. Maybe they saw hotels coming in. I don't know. And they wanted to make sure that they knew they weren't going to compete with Airbnb in the city. But it really deprives people of some income. It deprives you of your property rights, deprives you of the right to do in your home what you wish to do while you're there. And they could claim zoning. So they were claiming zoning and saying, well, the hotels are over there and your house is over here. Even though, because you rent a room in your house, didn't mean really anything. It didn't mean that you were conducting a business out of your home. It just meant that somebody wanted to sleep in a room in your house and you're saying, okay, it's $100 tonight. It had no effect on neighbors. It truly didn't. Maybe maybe a few neighbors got upset by it, but that's maybe because they're the nosy neighbor. Cause usually when people go to an Airbnb, they're usually not throwing a party. The residents are there and the homeowner is there. And so it doesn't really result in the same thing as a rental property. But I did find that ruling very interesting when it came to the control aspect. And zoning laws are all about control. And they really did seek, when they first started out, especially in Baltimore, it really was about separating and controlling the people. It still is. It hasn't changed at all. And now what it does is those zoning laws now prop up government in a way we've never seen before. And that is to the entity of private business, because now they can control where they have property, how much that's valued for, how much they can sell that for. They can jump into business themselves. And we have huge, huge problems with that. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
You're bringing up control, and you're probably correct, but it's about taxes.
It is. It is. And it's control over that money.
100 years ago, Grandma, planning. Or women, usually widows, would have extra space and rent out rooms to bring some extra cash in, which they sorely needed. And people were more civilized back then.
Well, they're civilized now.
Look them up and down and say, yeah, this is a suitable person that won't cause any trouble, and we'll, and people were genteel. Mm-hmm. But we've become so uncivilized, and the government wants taxes, so they got to go. I mean, they don't have to, but they're going after every single bit of freedom we got so they can get their fingers in there and get a cut of the money exchange.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my opinion.
Money and control. You got it. Thank you. Yeah. Also, very much control, because if you really looked at the number of people that were even doing Airbnb here, there wasn't that many. It was a very, very small group. Not a threat at all. And even if it was, what happens in your own home? If you want to rent a room to, like, say, one of your friend's kids because they're going to go to Dixie State, aren't you allowed to do that? I mean, that's where the control factor for me gets me. And if somebody needs to make a mortgage payment and the only way to do that is to rent out a room a couple times a month, that's your prerogative. City government should have absolutely no right to tell you what to do. Remember the old, you know, not harming anyone else rule? I think they forget about that. Yeah, I think we need an overhaul of city government, tell you the truth. Be right back on the Kate Daly Show with Melissa. You're going to love this. There's a couple of items here that I'm actually excited to talk about because they're so different. And then in the last hour, I want to present something on a topic too. Susan will come in, and I also want to present something on a topic that takes it from a whole different realm. So be right back on the Kate Daly Show.
Have you downloaded?